Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
January 6, 1896. I went to see the sick man today, and he's a pitiful-looking devil. They had him with about 6 blankets, and he still was nearly freezing. I can do nothing for him. January 12th. I went to see him today, and he looks worse than ever. I gave him a dose of castor oil, but he says his heart is freezing. He keeps insisting he'll become a cannibal. He wants the Algonquins to kill him before he gets worse. January 20th. Francois came here and asked me if I would read some prayers for the sick man. He doesn't look like a human being. He seems to be terribly swollen in the body and face. The sight of him is enough to frighten any person. The poor Algonquin slept very little here for the last 19 days. Since he arrived, they have been watching him all the time. I don't know how this will end. January 21st. Francois came for me last night and I went with him. I told him we ought to take some rope with us and tie him up if we could. The sound of him was terrible. It was like the calling of a wild animal. We tied him with the ropes, and I left to find some more, but I couldn't find any, and when I got back, the cords around his arms were already breaking. The Algonquins asked what we should do. They said that when he got up, he would kill all of us. I told them to do what they had to do, as I had no more ropes with which to bind him.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And that was the account of Francis Work Beaton, the Orkney HBC clerk at the Trout Lake Outpost, the winter of 1896 during the alleged Wendigo possession of Nepapin Augur. Edited slightly for clarity's sake, but otherwise exactly what's in the history books.
And we wanted to bring that bit to your attention because what we're talking about is a creature or a possession that has to deal with cannibalism.
Yeah, and even though the creature itself is obviously a creature of myth, we've talked before about the power of myth, the power of paranormal scripts within a culture, as well as the real-life incidences that have allegedly occurred because of or alongside the Wendigo belief. Because if the oral account of this particular Wendigo possession story, as collected by the University of Alberta's Nathan D. Carlson, holds true, then the Algonquin tribespeople gave Nepapin boiling bear grease in an attempt to cure him after this account that I read. Mm-hmm. And then when that didn't work, they executed him with an axe, cutting off his head and burying it separate from his body. Now, there are various problems, of course, with any account of cannibalism, just cannibalism alone, much less when you start involving supernatural material as well.
Yeah, and that's the thing about Wendo that is so interesting, is it really highlights this issue of cannibalism. And we've talked about this before. It's very hard to really pin down cannibalism, what has actually happened
with humans, for sure.
Actually, in nature, it's very easy to explain, right?
Yeah, because they're not ashamed of it.
They're not ashamed, and they have a purpose, a real clear purpose to their cannibalism. I mean, you have the sexual cannibalism in orb spiders, right?
Yeah.
That helps in terms of sexual reproduction fitness. And then in tiger sharks, you have siblicide, right? You have a tiger shark that eats a sibling because it's an easy source of energy.
Yeah, it's just pure economics. It's a harsh world. Sometimes you have to reabsorb energy back into the winning prospects, and that's just how it goes. But of course, in human culture, the economics may still hold true,
mm-hmm.
but we have all of these layers of moral concerns, of society and culture that just complicate the equation.
Well, I mean, when you say the economics, you're talking about survival cannibalism. In other
yes.
words, you're just at the end of your rope, and you may be with someone who could provide you with a bit of energy, or perhaps there is even a body that has recently passed that someone uses, and we have many accounts of this survival cannibalism in history.
Yeah, there are accounts that are proven,
yes.
And then there are accounts that are sort of forever being argued about, such as the Dahmer party, where some say, well, maybe they didn't resort to survival cannibalism. Others say yes. Some say, well, the bones, there's no bone evidence that they did. And others say, well, they wouldn't gnaw on the bones. They would have eaten the soft flesh. And, of course, the evidence of that wouldn't survive.
Yeah.
And then, you know, how many people are going to come back from a chaotic trip to the mountains and be like, woo, I only survived because I ate my friend Caleb.
It's just probably something that you're going to omit at cocktail parties, right?
Yes.
You've got the survival cannibalism, and then just to complicate things a little bit further, we have these accounts of cultural rituals, which may or may not be symbolic cannibalism, right? They may actually mm-hmm. have occurred or occurred in different ways that we don't think is cannibalistic.
Yeah, well, I mean, you always have the outsider viewing some sort of supposedly cannibalistic ceremony or hearing about it. You're having Westerners observe or hear about a ritual that from a people that they view as primitive.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's hard to tack down the actual truth of the matter.
Yeah, actually, if you want to look at a good example of this and someone who actually furthered this idea of cannibalism, you can look to Columbus, who encountered the Arawak people in Hispaniola during the 15th century. And they warned him of another tribe, the Carib, that ate people, which it appears this other tribe never existed.
Yeah.
So this has been really hard for anthropologists to go through and to try to figure out. But as far as I can tell, this other tribe just wasn't a reality. So it may have just been for them this story about another tribe.
Just kind of a boogeyman.
A boogeyman,
yeah,
right.
You tell in the night, there's another tribe out there, and they're so bad they eat people. You don't want to be like that, and you don't want them to come for you.
Right. Or maybe they just wanted, you know, Columbus to hang around.
Yeah.
And they were like, hey, we need to get them to stay here with us and not go exploring. So in addition, Columbus may have mistaken the ritual of keeping a loved one's bones around the house. So that's what the Arawak people did, and he may have mistaken that for evidence of cannibalism.
And, of course, the whole thing is ridiculous, too, when you realize that Columbus comes bearing his Catholic faith.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Catholicism, like a lot of Christianity, is rich in this symbolic consumption of Christ's blood and flesh, which even though you're not actually consuming blood mm-hmm. and flesh, it is symbolic cannibalism at heart.
Right, which we see in so many other cultures.
Yeah.
The problem, of course, is that Columbus was the authority on all matters yes. foreign at that point. So people are like, so where'd you go? What'd you see? What'd you experience? And then whatever he said became sort of the gospel.
Yeah, and that's one of the problems you have throughout history, too. I mean, going back to Pliny the Elder and all these guys,
mm-hmm.
where you just have certain voices, and there aren't a lot of there's not a lot of discussion about the matter, but you know, this guy said that there are cannibals living in Africa, and that remains sort of the voice of truth for a matter of centuries.
So that's why the Wendigo is such an interesting thing to look at, because it really gets at the heart of the taboo of cannibalism, but also the psychology of it, the ways in which we behave when we have these folktales as stand-ins for what becomes a reality.
Yeah. So, I want you to imagine a dark, gaunt giant that haunts the woods, clad only in matted hair, and it's peering out at you from the wild depths with blood-red eyes as wild as sinister as those of an owl, with claws that are curled and muscles that are coiled with the strength of a bear, and its teeth are eager, and its foul tongue is longing for the taste of human flesh.
That sounds cuddly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is something that is, this creature is known to different North American tribal groups. And when we're talking about the geography here, we're talking about French-Canadian territory. And the Algonquins, they figure in this quite a bit, as well as a couple of other tribes.
Yeah, the Algonquins is one of the most populous and widespread North American native language groups. Mm-hmm. And at different times, it composed like a whole bunch of different tribes. You know, there were a lot of different tribes that spoke the Algonquin tongue, and there was a lot of shared beliefs among them. And they thrived in the harsh world of northern North America, a land of vast, unforgiving wilderness, brutal winters, particularly during the Little Ice Age era in the 17th to 19th centuries.
Which correlates exactly with a lot of this exploration by French Canadians who met up with these different tribes, and we'll talk about this more, but they began to actually adopt some of these folktales of the Wendigo. And I also wanted to mention that it goes by Witikow, Witigo, Witikyo, and Wendigo, Wendigo, Wendiga, Witiko, and Witigo.
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 I liked Witigo. It sounds like a corporation.
Yeah.
It secretly is based on cannibalism.
It's right. Witigo. You can Witigo too. And the cool thing about this is that the Wendigo really sort of describes two different things at play here.
Mm-hmm.
One is the beast that you described, who lives in that forest waiting to feast on a human. The other is a cannibalistic spirit that can possess a human.
Yeah, and that spirit kind of walks the barrier between the world and the world of the spirits. And, of course, that's a very important area in the tales and the belief systems and the worldview of the first people of North America.
Yeah, and if you look at the Algonquins, they really focus on these spirits as a sort of cautionary tale to people during these very harsh winters, not to turn to cannibalism, because they're saying that if you eat the flesh of another, well, your soul is now susceptible to the Wendigo.
Yeah. There were a number of causes, a number of things that could turn you into a Wendigo. Most of them are based in diet and food and hunger. So you might be cursed by a sorcerer. Always a possibility.
Happens.
You know, it'll happen. If you yourself are a sorcerer, you might seek the transformation yourself. Always an option.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You might trigger the change if you fast too long or feast too heavily. So a little too much food, a little too little food, you're going to potentially open yourself up to the Wendigo's caress. But most importantly of all, as you mentioned, if you were forced to consume human flesh, or if you're tricked into doing so, even in a dream, then the Wendigo can reach out to you, touch your soul, and bring on this steady and horrible change.
And then you might feel ice in your heart.
Yeah.
Dreams and a longing for flesh.
Yeah, because that's the big thing, right? There are a number of symptoms. According to the Algonquin Reports catalog by Nathan D. Carlson, the symptoms include stupor, catatonia, depression, paranoia, anorexia, or the inability to hold down food, nausea, vomiting, emaciation, glazed eyes, bodily or facial swelling, violence, shouting, hallucinations of family members as food animals, particularly as beavers, and finally, this unstoppable urge to consume human flesh. Yeah, there was one account that I was reading in a separate book where like a mother was potentially turning into a Wendigo, and she was telling her, she was mad at her children. She's saying, "You all look like beavers to me now."
So, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's that. But the big thing, the major symptoms and the ultimate symptoms are the unstoppable urge to consume human flesh, and this chill in your torso, in your heart, as your heart becomes this lump of ice.
That's right, as the transformation occurs.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll talk about psychosis.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O Allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. We were just talking about the symptoms in the folk tales of the Wendigo, and how your heart may seem to become this lump of ice, and you have this irresistible urge to consume human flesh. Now, there were a few curative measures that were also related in the folk tales.
What I think is interesting before you talk about the curative measures is that people took this folklore and then they began to exhibit these symptoms. And this is what that psychosis is. These cases of people actually coming down with not actually turning into these sort of werewolf-like creatures, but actually committing some dastardly acts.
Yeah, because on one hand, as Nathan D. Carlson points out in his excellent article reviewing Wendigo, an ethnohistory of cannibal monsters in the Athabasca district of northern Alberta, 1878 through 1910, this was not just you know, a folk tale that was told. This was something in which there was a lot of belief. There was a lot of fear. He says, quote, "In the collective belief systems of pre-21st century Algonquins, contrary to the opinions of some modern academics as discussed below, the Witigo condition was not a legendary fabrication. For example, in early 1896, Richard Young, the Anglican bishop of the Athabasca district, wrote the following in a letter journal to the evangelical fathers in the Church Missionary Society. Quote, "The Indians have a great terror of these so-called Wendigos, or cannibals. They believe that after eating human flesh, their heart becomes a lump of ice and no one alive is safe for them. Absurd as all of this sounds, to us, it is a real terror to the untutored Indian." So there's a little, obviously there's a bit of xenophobia and racism in that that particular portrayal, but still it underlines that this was serious medicine. And if you're in a situation where you have been forced to resort to survival cannibalism, and then it's known, or even if it's known only to you,
you
return.
You had a certain shame about it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you return with shame. Mm-hmm. Perhaps other members of your group know that this occurred, and before you know it, you're ostracized. And maybe you feel, and there are a number of these symptoms, like there's this whole list of possible symptoms, and if you experience one of them, or feel like you experience one of them, combined with the guilt that you feel, then how long before you begin manifesting this paranoid idea you were transforming?
Yeah, let's set the scene for this too. We are talking about these sort of starvation winters that would occur in this part of the world, particularly, as you said, during that period from the 17th century to the 19th century. And, you know, you have people who would sort of collectively get together as families during that time and band together and try to survive. Mm-hmm. But there is still a huge amount of isolation. So you might be with 5, 6, 7 of your family members, you know, out in the middle of nowhere with this wind whistling or this wind howling. And when you look at these Algonquin depictions, the wind is a huge force here.
Yeah.
So have you ever been like on the mountain before and there's just huge amounts of wind coming in at your structure if you're in a tent or in a cabin?
Yeah. It's just if you're out in the open, it's just whipping by you. It's all you can hear in your ears. And if you're in a structure or even, you know, in the shelter of a tree or some stone, then it's just whistling by and it varies. It's this changing tone, almost the song.
Yeah, and I remember when I was in Costa Rica, Monteverde, and I spent a couple of nights in a cabin on the top of the mountain there, and the first night I was like, oh, this is beautiful, it's gorgeous. The second night I was like, this is awful. I cannot get any sleep, the wind is howling. The third night I started to feel like I was going crazy. So imagine months of this going on.
I want to say, if you resort to cannibalism in Monteverde, that's on you. Don't try and pin that on a Wendigo.
Well, that's the thing, right? So I go out with a friend. We're going to go try to trap something. You know, maybe he breaks his leg. You know, things aren't looking good for him. So I off him and I have a little bit of his meat. And then as you said, you come back to camp or to your cabin and you're feeling the shame for it.
Yeah.
Now, I did want to point out that Kevin Volkin, a professor of psychology, he's often called on as a behavioral expert on TV shows and the like, he categorizes it as an extreme form of cabin fever. So again, you've got harsh environmental factors there. You're with a couple of people and things can go awry.
Yeah, you're with a bunch of people that you love but are also maybe driving you a little crazy.
Yeah.
And I mean, because that's one of the common tropes of the Wendigo story is you have a mom or a dad or even both that go nuts and start eating the kids. And then, you know, you eat one kid, then you eat the second, and then it just gets out of hand.
Yeah, and Volkin says it becomes a compulsion. So there you are in your cabin, the wind howling for months on end, and you begin to really think that you are the Wendigo, right? It's taken hold of you. You're feeling icy in your heart, and your child is starting to look like a drumstick.
Yeah, or beaver.
Beaver. Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to continue talking about that particular strain. But just to go back, presented cures that were explored for the Wendigo situation. Carlson relates several from different sources, but they include drinking high wines by the fire, which sounds rather pleasant. I would say that should be your first stop on any attempt to treat a suspected Wendigo situation. Next, the consumption of heated or even boiling animal fats. So you have some moose meat, bear meat, what have you. You heat the fat up, get it nice and boiling, and then you drink it. Now, both of these methods, drinking by the fire and drinking hot animal fat, the idea is that it would help burn away the ice that is formed in the heart. Mm. That's the key to the Wendigo. There was another tale that I believe Carlson related, in which there was a group of Wendigos, mm-hmm. and they were just a complete terror, and eat everyone in sight. And they were particularly hard to deal with because, on one hand, Wendigos were said to be bulletproof, or bullets didn't affect them, and the only way to really kill them was to deal with that icy heart. Mm-hmm. But these Wendigos had taken their icy hearts out and stored them elsewhere, so that they were not susceptible to that.
Clever.
Yeah. So those are some options. Also, you could, of course, get a spirit medium to use a shaking tent ritual, which is a special tent in which spirits could be summoned. But if these didn't work, the only thing to do was to tie the Wendigo down and hack it to pieces with an axe, burying the pieces so as to keep it from becoming whole again and killing everyone in sight.
Now, someone by the name of Jack Fiddler, an Oki Cree member, actually took that to heart and became the Van Helsing for his community of Wendigos. He claimed to have slayed 14 people who were possessed, and he was in prison when he murdered a woman who he says was on the verge of turning into a Wendigo.
Oh.
So just so you know, there were people out there that were trying to actually, stop it before it started, what they really thought was going to be a possession. And of course, we have so many different examples of people who actually did this to their families, who actually ate their families. So you can see why someone like Jack Fiddler might really take this to heart as his cause, mm-hmm. his reason for being.
Yeah. Now, of course, one of the problems we mentioned with cannibalism and cannibalism stories. So the Wendigo stories were told around the campfire by Algonquin tribespeople who really loved stories and mm-hmm. told stories. And the nature of stories that are told is that you take on stories as your own that are other people's. You prop up a story by saying you were there when you weren't. All of these things happen. The fish gets a little larger with each telling. Etc. And then you have the French Canadian voyagers, mm-hmm. the travelers, mm-hmm. who are meeting these people, trading mm-hmm. stories with them, and of course they're really into telling stories as well. So we can't take every story to heart, but some of them are actually really well founded. For instance, the Swift Runner case. Mm-hmm. Now this was a Cree trapper who serially murdered and consumed the bodies of his wife and five children. And this was near Athabasca Landing Trading Post in the north central Alberta in the winter of 1878. And all the murders, except the last one, were more of a clear case of starvation cannibalism. Mm-hmm. But then the last one, well, I'll just read you what he had to say when he was interviewed. He said, "At that moment, the Wendigo suddenly took possession of my soul, and in order to live longer, far from people, and to put out of the way the only witness to my crime, I seized my gun and killed the last of my children, and ate him as I had done the others. Some weeks later, I was taken by the police, sentenced to death, and in 3 days, I am to be hanged." And indeed, this is where it gets a little extra historical importance added to this, mm-hmm. is that according to Carlson, Swift Runner was the first person hanged by the Mounties, the Mounted Police, which gives this Swift Runner Wendigo case a unique position in the history of Canadian jurisprudence.
So the thing about this is that we don't know that it's actually a psychosis.
Right.
In fact, academics have seen it, or they've talked about it as a culture-bound psychosis. But they've also called it perhaps a culturally localized manifestation of paranoid schizophrenia, because mm-hmm. we see some mental illness in this area. And then a correlate of scapegoating. And then also in Nathan D. Carlson's paper, Reviving Wendigo, he says that it could have been a culturally mediated performance. So in some ways, again, it was taking to heart this story and performing it in a way. Perhaps that person didn't actually want the taste of flesh, but they were caught up in the moment in these long winters and the sort of dis-ease that would settle in with this. And maybe they began to display these histrionics.
Yeah, and then also there are situations where you can well imagine one using the Wendigo idea and Wendigo stigma for personal gain. Like, for instance, here at work, so we all have new desks.
Mm-hmm.
Loudermilk, Allison Loudermilk, has a particularly nice desk. It's like right next to the window. Mm-hmm. It's pretty good. So I can imagine that if Loudermilk were to be accused of being a Wendigo,
mm-hmm.
Someone might say, well, hey, I kind of want Loudermilk's desk, so I'm going to jump in on that bandwagon. and try to push that that idea among my my fellow coworkers. Uh-huh. And then you eventually reach the point where there's nothing left to do but chop her into pieces, and then lo and behold, I'm sitting in her new desk.
Okay, so you're the one who started the rumor.
Yes.
About not going into the bathroom alone.
Yes.
When Loudermilk was using it.
Yes, and about what she's really been bringing in her lunch pail.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The second thing I want to mention is that some of us might apply a little magical thinking to that space.
Yes.
And think that they wouldn't want to inhabit it for fear of being possessed by the Wendigo as well.
Yeah, exactly.
I just wanted to point that out.
Okay. But maybe I'm strong enough to sit there is my thing.
I'm just going to keep my desk far away from you just in case, though.
Okay. Well, fair enough. All right, we're going to do another break, and when we come back, we're going to keep discussing the Wendigo myth and some of the really interesting cultural aspects of it.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. We're still talking about the Wendigo myth of the Algonquin people. And of course, it's been picked up over the years. We're going to talk a little bit about how it was picked up by the French Canadians. But of course, even in modern culture, you see it show up in different forms of media. For instance, Stephen King's novel Pet Sematary has a Wendigo in it that I remember is working pretty well. The movie Ravenous it also features the Wendigo myth pretty strongly, kind of taking it and combining with Western vampire folklore to create kind of I think an interesting animal. It's been a while since I've seen it, but it has a really awesome soundtrack by Damon Albarn of Blur and Gorillaz and minimalist composer Michael Nyman. And let's see, there was Larry Fresden's film Wendigo, which was like an indie horror film that was pretty interesting. And the TV show Hannibal has sort of dream hallucination sequences in which a Wendigo character appears that I thought was pretty effective.
And one of the pieces of media that may have started at all in terms of mass consumption, sorry about that pun, is Algernon Blackwood's 1907 short story, The Wendigo.
You know, and I like Algernon Blackwood. Mm-hmm. I have enjoyed his writing in the past, but I started to reread his Wendigo story, mm-hmm. and I have to say I didn't like it. I didn't feel like it was really very Wendigo-y. You know, it was just, he kind of took the name Wendigo and a certain amount of the feeling for it, but then it felt flat a bit.
Well, though, you could say that at that point, Blackwood didn't have this sort of vast stores
That's
of
true.
Information about the Wendigo to pull from.
He couldn't go to the Wikipedia or listen to our podcast.
He probably had a French-Canadian friend who was like, let me tell you about this crazy thing that happened to a friend of a friend of a friend of mine's.
Right, and when someone tells you a story like that, especially when it's from a different culture, what can you do but combine the scraps that you are given that may or may not make sense from your own cultural standpoint, you combine it with the ideas that you already have in your own culture, and you end up with sort of a new animal, a new myth emerges from this synthesis of ideas.
Yeah, so let's sort of do some time traveling here to, say, the Lake Superior region in Canada, 1850s. You probably would hear a French Canadian really complaining about this really harsh winter and saying that they were so hungry and there were so little resources that they actually boiled their moccasins and ate them. I mean, these are true accounts. And
But then also of the story that is so popular that you end up telling it even if you didn't necessarily experience it.
Right. And then, of course, one thing leads to another and you start talking about cannibalism, right?
Right.
Because you say, oh, man, if I ate my moccasins, whew, I'm just 2 seconds away from you, buddy, right? And the conversation gets really awkward.
Yes, this was all excellently discussed in Werewolves and Wendigos, Narratives of Cannibal Monsters in French-Canadian Voyageur Oral Tradition by Caroline Potruchny of York University, where she really goes into what happens when the French-Canadian voyageurs encounter the Algonquins and start swapping tales.
Yeah, because you have to, again, sort of imagine this time period. There were missionaries, fur traders, colonists, the voyageurs all going through and meeting different tribes and then hearing about these atrocities. Now, if you are someone who is French Canadian, you might be familiar with some other folklore from Europe, like, say, werewolves. So it wouldn't be too crazy because you may have a belief system that supports that.
Yeah, because the werewolf myth, of course, is that on certain nights, because of the moon, maybe some curses are in play as well, but a man transforms into a wolf or a wolf-like being and then goes out and eats things, including human flesh. And then the next morning he's like, whoa, what happened? What did I do? What horrible things happened to me? What kind of monster did I become?
Right. And then you've got the whole, like, man, I was boiling my moccasins and you have all these other accounts. In fact, I wanted to bring up Jamestown, 1609. Mm-hmm. That colony had such a harsh winter that we know that they engaged not in just eating, say, dogs, cats, and horses, but recently this year, the bones of a 14-year-old girl were excavated. And Douglas Owsley, he's the Smithsonian forensic anthropologist who analyzed the bones, says, given these bones in a trash pit, all cut up and chopped up, it's clear that this body was dismembered for consumption. So in the same way, if you have this folklore from Europe and you know about werewolves, you know that people can be transformed into them. And you also have these folk tales standing in for moral code, then as a European who is in this territory, this Algonquin territory, you probably would say, wow, we got to watch out here.
Yeah, because, I mean, the werewolf myth ultimately revolves around the idea, you know, what happens if I give in to my bestial nature? What if my, my bestial nature overcomes me? What if I give in to the economic sensibility of cannibalism, for instance, despite all of my human moral standing? And so there's a lot of comparisons to be made between the werewolf myth and the Wendigo myth. And you can definitely see where the werewolf myth would help you understand the Wendigo myth. Even though the Wendigo myth is totally about human, human flesh being consumed, totally about cannibalism, whereas cannibalism is just sort of one aspect of the werewolf myth.
Yes, Padruchny actually says, in as you say, her fine paper, that what we can learn from this is that the cannibal monster stories that voyageurs told each other reveal many aspects of their lives and cosmology, such as starvation, mental illness, and metamorphosis. Because in a way, they were undergoing a transformation themselves.
Yeah, they started out as Westerners in a strange world. They travel out into this just, I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine. There, some books have really done a great job of portraying this excursion into the wilds of some of this territory. I think of like Northwest Passage. I also think of Black Robe, excellent book. You go into this just rich, wild world where there are no Westerners. There are these foreign peoples that you can only partially understand that have a totally different worldview than you do. And then you start and you're in dealing with limited resources. You're suddenly you find yourself starving or you're ill. And then what are you to make of all that? And then over time, you have the Westerners assimilating more and more with the native cultures to the point where they're taking Algonquin brides. They're becoming their own communities,
right?
With this shared mythos that has been weaved together from both the Algonquin traditions and the European traditions that they imported.
And yet xenophobia exists, and that's where it becomes really interesting, because the Wendigo is really a stand-in for this otherness. As you said, these are people in a new land with new experiences, and everything is the other, including the Algonquin at some point and other tribes. So, you know, with the Wendigo carries this idea that you're engaging in this other world, the supernatural world.
You know, I can't, in thinking about the Wendigo, I keep coming back to some material that we came across in our episode on the problem of hell, where we talked about the old gods that societies had, the hunter-gatherer gods, the horned gods that were more chaotic, that were that dealt thematically with the scarcity of food and the uncertainty of tomorrow's meal and the meal after that. And in doing so, you can see why the Wendigo is really the ultimate evil spirit of the Algonquins, because it represents the uncertainty of food. It represents the likelihood even at times of starvation and falling, what it would take to fall below the barrier, the threshold for civilization, you know, because I feel like a lot of our stories deal with that. Like we watch a show like Breaking Bad, and we see like these characters, you see a character that's falling throughout the entire show. And at what point does he fall below the threshold? And you see these other characters that, you know, addicts and whatnot. And you look at them and you think, there is a character who's fallen below the threshold. Woe is, you know, would be me if I were to fall that low as well. And, in a society like that is the base mark, cannibalism. You've fallen below the moral standing that defines and protects the culture.
Well, right, and it's a reminder of that time period when the line between, you know, death and survival, which is just like that. You could cross over it so quickly. So it would be tempting to engage in cannibalism if you had to, because it may be the difference between life and death.
Indeed. Padruchny points out that a lot of these stories, these shared stories of the Wendigo that the French Canadians shared with the Algonquins, that there were two lessons essentially in all of them, particularly for the French Canadian listener. First of all, the idea that the native peoples are your friend, or at least to be relied upon in the wilds. Because a lot of these stories, they end with either you're starving and some Algonquins come along and they feed you, and then you're saved. Or Wendigo situation happens and they're the ones who come with the knowledge of how to defeat the Wendigo, or they actually chop it up for you. But then the second lesson, and this lesson, she says, is a little more subdued. The lesson is that starvation cannibalism is an option. It's kind of a whisper in the ear saying, so this is horrible, but if you got to do it, you can do it.
And if it's going to get whispered into your ear, you might as well blame it on the wind, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the thing about this is that anthropologists, when they began to study this in earnest, found that it pretty much dried up all of these expressions of Wendigo possession, just evaporated. Mm-hmm. So again, it brings into question whether or not it was really a psychosis, or if maybe this part of the world was opening up and, there were other influences going on.
So there you have it. The Wendigo, one of my favorite monsters, evil spirits, and one that's just so rich, just such a rich creature, a rich mythological idea, and I love how it also exists in this meeting of worlds with these two distinct alien cultures of the French Canadians and the Algonquins coming together.
Yeah, and now I challenge you guys to go and watch American Werewolf in London. Again, if you've already seen it or mm-hmm. for the first time, and think about it through that lens, because it becomes a bit of a different movie, still stellar, maybe even better, actually.
And I would also challenge anyone to take the idea with you, too, that the Wendigo may come to you in your dreams. So throughout the next week, as you dream, interpret your dreams in light of the Wendigo myth. Was there ice? Was there a chilling wind? Were there did the beast itself appear to you in the woods? I'd love to hear about that.
Now I feel like we should have like a logo with the Wendigo challenge.
The Wendigo challenge.
It. Yeah.
All right, so hey, you want to get in touch with us about any of that? You know the general ways to do it. You can go to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is our core website. That's the mothership. That's where everything winds up eventually. But you can also find us on social media. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are on Tumblr. We're on Google Plus. We have a YouTube account, Mind Stuff Show. And Julie, if they want to send us a good old-fashioned email, how can they go about that?
Well, after they visit stufftoblowyourmind.com, they can send us an email at blowthemind@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.